firming up a fragile ceasefire. I'm Pam Pusa, Fox News. Egyptian mediators are working to prolong the peace between Israel and Palestinian militants in Gaza. Secretary of State Antony Blinken will head to the region next week as President Biden reaffirms his commitment to Israel's security. The White House is also looking at what comes next.
We still need a two-state solution. It is the only answer.
The president also says Washington will work with the UN to bring humanitarian aid to Gaza. More than 500,000 service members in South Korea will receive coronavirus vaccines from the U.S. The president made the announcement yesterday while meeting with his South Korean counterpart. They plan to keep talking, but Senate Republicans and the White House are said to be far apart on an infrastructure package.
A counteroffer from the White House proposes spending $1.7 trillion on an infrastructure bill. That is down from $2.25 trillion initially asked for by President Biden.
Fox's Jared Halpern, the GOP remains opposed to tax increases to pay for the plan. Another black eye for the federal prison system. Authorities say the two New York guards who were supposed to be keeping an eye on accused sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein weren't.
The workers, Tovin Knoll and Michael Thomas, were accused of sleeping and browsing the internet instead of watching Epstein the night he took his own life in August of 2019. They were charged with lying on prison records to make it seem like they made the required checks of Epstein. New York City medical examiners ruled his death a suicide. As part of a plea deal, the duo will serve no time behind bars.
Fox's Chris DeMeo, Senator Ben Sasse calls the deal unacceptable. Subtropical storm Anna has formed in the Atlantic off Bermuda. It's the season's first named storm. America's listening to Fox News. When California reopens next month, social distancing will be a thing of the past. Health officials say that's because new cases of the coronavirus are dramatically lower and vaccinations are on the rise. The June 15th reopening will allow businesses to operate at full capacity. As for masks, the state is expected to adjust its guidelines to correspond to national guidelines. For the time being, the CDC is recommending that masks continue to be worn in school.
The CDC and Georgia Department of Public Health looked at elementary schools throughout this state, and what they found is that schools that required teachers and staff to wear masks had 37% fewer cases than schools that did not. And schools with improved ventilation systems had 39% fewer cases. Researchers looked further at the types of ventilation and found schools that simply improved the flow of fresh air into classrooms reduced COVID cases by 35%, but schools that improved filtration, in other words, systems to remove hazardous particles from the air, they reduce case numbers by 48%.
Fox's Jonathan Seri. The graduating class at a college outside Boston got more than inspiration at their commencement ceremony yesterday. Each graduate walked off campus with some cold, hard cash.
Robert Hale is the CEO of Granite Telecommunications and owner of development company Fox Rock Properties. During his commencement address at Quincy College, the 490 graduating students got some advice and two checks for $500 each. Hale told students one check was to keep, the other to give away to an organization or individual who needs it more than themselves. Hale said he wanted to give each student the experience of giving. He added students worked hard and should celebrate. He also wanted to help in that effort.
Fox's Ann Carey. I'm Pam Pusa, Fox News.
If you're traveling on 95 in the Elk Ridge area, be aware that southbound approaching 195, all four travel lanes are blocked with accident activity, but traffic is getting by on the shoulder, but do watch out for delays there. Also, on the outer loop of the BW Parkway, you will still find accident activity on that off-ramp. Earlier accident westbound on Route 3 near Salem Church Road in Fredericksburg has been cleared away. Look out for road work, though. Westbound on 66 between Nutley Street and 123, three lanes will be blocked. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
We'll see partly sunny to mostly cloudy skies today. We'll have filtered sunshine at times. It will be hotter, though. Highs back into the lower 90s this afternoon. Also, the outside chance for a stray shower through the afternoon hours, but a very low possibility for that. As we head later on tonight, lows back in the 50s to around 60 degrees under partly cloudy skies. For your Sunday, partly cloudy, still hot, highs in the lower 90s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Now, the Saturday morning update.
105.9 FM, WMAL. Good morning. It is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you for being with us. Jeff Wolf is behind the console. Jane Houtenin, our producer this morning. To start things off, there is peace in the Mideast. It's a fragile peace, but at least it is peace. It's day two of the ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. Both sides say they will honor their agreements if the other does not attack. Humanitarian aid is now arriving in the area. President Biden spoke about it yesterday. He was at the White House, of course, welcoming the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in. Moon Jae-in, the second foreign leader to visit the U.S. after Japanese Prime Minister Suga came last month. There was a question and answer period after the ceremony. And here is how President Biden addressed the question about Israel and his relationship with Prime Minister Netanyahu. There have been a lot of questions about that recently, and here's how the president laid it out.
One of the reasons why we're able to get the ceasefire in 11 days, they didn't do what other people have done. I don't talk about what I tell people in private. I don't talk about what we negotiate in private. But I can assure you, though, is that the last time it took 56 days and then 6 months to get a ceasefire. I'm praying this ceasefire will hold. I take Bibi Netanyahu when he gives me his word. I take him at his word. He's never broken his word to me. And but what I've made clear is that it's essential. It's essential that the Palestinians in on the West Bank be secured, that Abbas be recognized as the leader of the Palestinian people, which he is. Hamas is a terrorist organization. We recognize that. But that doesn't mean we should not be in Gaza, rebuilding Gaza for all those innocent people who, in fact, have been hurt and have been collateral damage, including the loss of homes and a whole range of other things, as well as insisting that Israeli citizens, whether they be Arab or Jew, are treated equally.
So that is the president speaking about his relationship with Bibi Netanyahu. Now, there have been a lot of questions, you know, this week about the divide in the Democratic Party. Of course, members of the squad have been very critical of Israel, and President Biden was asked about that situation in the Democratic Party.
What is your message to Democrats who want you to be more confrontational with Israel and specifically to those that are saying that there should be an end to arms sales? I mean, do you recognize that there's been a shift and an evolution in your party, Mr. President, in the last 20 years on this issue? And I have a question for President Moon, but I can wait or I can guess that.
There is no shift in my commitment. The commitment to the security of Israel, period. No shift, not at all. But I tell you what there is a shift in. The shift is that we still need a two-state solution. It is the only answer, the only answer. And what I'm convinced of is that we can now move, as I did even before I was able to negotiate, before the ceasefire was negotiated. That I made it clear that I spoke with President Abbas. We're going to make sure that we are going to provide for security in the West Bank, and we renewed the security commitment, as well as economic commitment to the people on the West Bank.
And it was kind of interesting if you watched the press conference. It was obviously set up in that the president knew which reporters he would call on. He only took several questions. But Peter Doocy shouted one out at the end, and it didn't appear as though that was anticipated by the Biden team because they didn't have a person with the kind of boom microphone right next to him so that they could record it as clearly as you heard the reporters' questions earlier because they were kind of structured there. So Peter shouts this one out. And, you know, Peter Doocy is kind of to the Biden administration what Jim Acosta was to the Trump administration. Now, in all fairness to Peter Doocy, I am not going to compare him to Jim Acosta, but I'm simply comparing sort of the attitude about the administrations toward the respective reporters. Anyway, here is how it went down with Peter Doocy asking Joe Biden a question.
Time for one more. If you're not asking me a mean one like you usually do.
It's something interesting, I think, that has not come up.
President Obama says that there is footage and records of objects in the skies, these unidentified aerial phenomenon, and he says we don't know exactly what they are. What do you think that it is?
I would ask him again. Thank you.
Okay, so what do you expect, you know, from President Biden toward Peter Ducey? What I found interesting in the answer was he shifted it back on President Obama. And a lot of people have sort of said, who's in charge at the White House? Is it Vice President Harris? Is it sort of a team of insiders in the White House? Or is it President Obama? So by deflecting the question back to the former quote-unquote president, maybe that's an indicator of who's running the show. Hey, ask the guy that's running the joint. Obama. Anyway, just a thought. It is 6:15. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAO. We got a lot to cover. We're going to get into some of the Cuomo Brothers Act coming up next. But first, Michelle Murray's in the WMAO Traffic Center.
On the Beltway, looks like an earlier accident on the outer loop of the BW Parkway has been cleared and traffic is running at speed. There is a new traffic pattern to be aware of on the inner loop between Arena Drive and Central Avenue. Your lanes divide two to the right and two to the left in the long-term bridge work zone. Now, on 95 in Elkridge, there is still accident activity. Southbound approaching 195, all four travel lanes are still blocked. However, traffic is getting by on the right shoulder. Watch for delays there. Now from GarageDoryPair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
We'll see partly sunny to mostly cloudy skies today. We'll have filtered sunshine at times. It will be hotter, though. Highs back into the lower 90s this afternoon. Also, the outside chance for a stray shower through the afternoon hours, but a very low possibility for that. As we head later on tonight, lows back in the 50s to around 60 degrees under partly cloudy skies. For your Sunday, partly cloudy, still hot, highs in the lower 90s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
64 degrees, nation's capital, 6:16 on the Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
Indeed, it is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you for joining us this morning. The governor of New York had a press conference. Boy, he used to love those press conferences, but I'm not so sure he's as crazy about them as he used to be. Governor Andrew Cuomo. And he was asked a question by a reporter about his book. As you know, he made a $5 million book deal on COVID-19 and his response to COVID-19. He was asked about it, and this is the question.
The book deal, I should say, was worth more than $5 million, and the allegations out there that you made that money on the backs of dead New Yorkers. How do you respond to that?
That's stupid. Next question.
Okay, I thought it was a pretty fair question. You know, you make $5 million on a book deal, and then you have a little trouble with fudging the numbers up there. Fair question, I think so. Well, there was a follow-up question. Here's how that went.
There was a person, Governor, who lost a loved one from COVID, and, you know, they were upset to see you making money writing a book about how you handled COVID. Why would it be stupid if they were bothered by that or thought there was something wrong with that? I mean, you used the word stupid a few minutes ago. Why would that be stupid?
I thought your question was stupid and offensive. I wrote a book saying this is what we should learn from what has happened so far in COVID because we're not done.
So I love it. You know, stupid question. The question was stupid. I thought it was a good question. I thought the answer was stupid. Now, there's been a lot of talk this week about Chris Cuomo, and it's, of course, the brother of Andrew Cuomo. And Chris Cuomo at CNN, he got into a situation, and you know the sexual harassment allegations against the governor, Andrew Cuomo. Well, Chris was participating in all of the strategy calls with the lawyers and even members of the governor's staff on these calls as to kind of how they would do damage control and prepare to defend the governor. And a lot of people are questioning the perception when you've got a major CNN anchor that's involved in that kind of strategy, including working with members of the governor's staff. So Chris Cuomo went on the air Thursday night, and he apologized.
It was a mistake because I put my colleagues here, who I believe are the best in the business, in a bad spot. I never intended for that. I would never intend for that. And I am sorry for that. I've never tried to influence this network's coverage of my brother. In fact, I've been walled off from it.
Well, the only reason he made that apology on Thursday night was because it came out in a Washington Post report that he had advised his brother on how to handle the sexual harassment accusations. Now, I get it. It is family. But maybe that advising should have been done quietly. And if he was going to advise, maybe he should have just listened to the call and talked to his brother after the call kind of quietly and not been so prominent, talking with staff and attorneys and everybody else. But, you know, he made his decision. He's apologized. Of course, CNN not doing anything about it. No suspension or anything else. So that's how that one's playing out. Teflon, that'll blow over 24 hours. Well, there's been a lot of talk about a commission to investigate the January 6th riots at the Capitol. The Democrats just will not stop in their efforts to just rip Donald Trump to shreds. Here's the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer this week, and he's talking about the Republicans and their resistance in the Senate to proceeding with another commission that'll probably cost tens of millions of dollars to investigate the riots on January 6th at the Capitol.
What the Republicans are doing, the House Republicans, is beyond crazy. To be so far under the thumb of Donald J. Trump, letting the most dishonest president in American history dictate the prerogatives of the Republican Party will be its demise. We all know there needs to be a thorough and honest accounting of what took place on January 6th, the greatest attempted insurrection since the Civil War.
So I like the zing in there about the most dishonest presidency. I think the Biden administration is competing for that honor. I mean, he wasn't going to pack the court during the campaign, and now there's talk of court packing. And there are a lot of other things that have kind of gone in a 180-degree direction. I love hearing the Secretary of Homeland Security every other day or so telling us how the border is closed. And then if you turn on Fox, you'll just see people streaming in from the other side of the southern border, the other side of the river. The integrity of this administration, not so sure. Anyway, we continue. How about credibility? How about our Speaker of the House? This is a gem, okay? And I wasn't even going to talk about the mask thing because everybody's made a big deal about the mask mandate on the House of Representatives, and I was going to just pass on it because I didn't think it was that big of a stink. But what I found interesting is that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, is fining Republicans who don't wear their masks in the House of Representatives. But Speaker Pelosi was at a White House event Thursday. There is an abundant amount of video of Speaker Pelosi not wearing her mask, hugging and chatting rather lengthy conversations with other unmasked guests at the White House. Now, we all know that if we've been vaccinated, the CDC said we can actually talk to people without a mask. If we've been vaccinated, they've been vaccinated. Well, apparently everybody at the White House event probably vaccinated by now. And we know everybody in the House, or the majority, have been vaccinated and have had the opportunity to be vaccinated, but she is still clinging to her mask mandate in the House of Representatives. And I got to thinking about it. Have you ever noticed that she wears a different mask every day that matches her outfit? And I'm kind of wondering if she's just extending the mandate so that she gets to wear each mask more than once. You know, we all hate wearing something one time and then putting it in the closet and it never comes out of the closet again. Maybe she's just trying to amortize her masks. Amortization, buy something, and then you kind of try and spread out the capital expenses by using it over a longer period of time. So it's just not one time. Well, anyway, it's kind of silly. But time to lift the mask mandate in the House, Madam Speaker, I would say. It is 6:24. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Plenty to cover this morning. We'll be joined by Jennifer Harper. Of course, she writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Interesting story on fake news from the other side of the perspectives. And also, what's happening in Oregon? Oh, secession in Oregon. That's a good one coming up. And also, we're going to talk about a couple of polls, including loyalty to President Trump. And a kind of a surprising opinion poll about immigration from National Public Radio. So we're going to talk with Jennifer Harper about that coming up pretty shortly. We're going to speak with Jim Trusty. Of course, he is our legal expert. And we'll talk to Jim about the announcement from the New York Attorney General that the probe into the Trump Organization, now a criminal investigation. And that's to run up some red flags with Jim Trusty, not about the Trump Organization, but about the Attorney General in New York. So we'll talk with Jim about that this morning. John Gizzi joins us in the 7 o'clock hour. Of course, White House correspondent and chief political columnist at Newsmax. We'll ask him about that divide in the Democratic Party over Israel. The January 6th Commission, what's the latest as that heads to the Senate? We'll ask John about that. And we got more to cover with John, including the states, the red states, 22 Republican governors in their efforts to discontinue the unemployment benefits to get people back to work. We'll ask John about that. Cheryl Atkinson will join us. She'll have an update on, you remember the aircraft that Donald Trump was using prior to being elected, big 757 he used at the rallies? Well, that's been in mothballs. It's coming back out. And he's made an announcement about it, which probably haven't heard it because the mainstream media and social media have banned him. Anything positive about Donald Trump, you certainly won't hear from the mainstream media or in social media. Cheryl Atkinson will have the announcement that came from the president's office in Mar-a-Lago. That's coming up. And also an interesting story on Alzheimer's research we'll get into with Cheryl Atkinson. Of course, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer joins us every Saturday morning, and he is our national security expert. And we're going to be talking about what's going on in the Department of Defense, some interesting things going on there, and also Hamas and Israel and, you know, some of the military tactics and strategies that have played out over the past 10 days there in the clash. We'll get into that with Tony Schaefer this morning. And then we'll ask KT basically her assessment of the Biden foreign policy moving forward, as we've seen some indications in the handling of the situation with Israel and Hamas, and also some of the things that he said yesterday at that press conference with the South Korean president at the White House. All coming up right here on the Saturday Morning Update. In the news this morning, prospects for a vast infrastructure deal are in doubt. The White House has reduced President Biden's sweeping proposal down to $1.7 trillion from $2.5 trillion, but Republican senators are rejecting that compromise as disappointing, saying that vast differences remain. The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki disclosed the new offer yesterday as cabinet secretaries and GOP senators were actually negotiating. President Biden says there has been no shift in his commitment to Israel's security, but insists a two-state solution that includes a state for Palestinians remains the only answer to that conflict. Biden speaking yesterday at a White House news conference. Today is the second day of that ceasefire after 11 days of Israeli-Hamas fighting that's killed well over 200 people. President Biden says he will not allow the Department of Justice to seize journalists' phone records and emails, calling the practice wrong in a significant departure from his predecessors. His comments come as CNN reported Thursday that the Trump administration Justice Department had secretly obtained the 2017 phone records of one of their correspondents. That is the latest revelation of an apparent leak investigation aimed at identifying a journalist source that was launched during the last administration. Time for a check of the traffic and weather. Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Virginia, westbound 66 between Nutley Street and 123, watch out for construction. Three lanes closed, but the left lane is getting by. But do watch out for some slowdowns in the area. So far, no delays on 95 from Dumfries in towards Springfield. Earlier accident in Fredericksburg, westbound on 3 near Salem Church Road cleared. And the earlier incident on the outer loop of the VW Parkway cleared as well. You will still find the crash activity and accident cleanup southbound on 95, approaching 195 in Elkridge, where the right shoulder is squeezing by. Watch for delays there. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
We'll see partly sunny to mostly cloudy skies today. We'll have filtered sunshine at times. It will be hotter, though. Highs back into the lower 90s this afternoon. Also, the outside chance for a stray shower through the afternoon hours, but a very low possibility for that. As we head later on tonight, lows back in the 50s to around 60 degrees under partly cloudy skies. For your Sunday, partly cloudy, still hot, highs in the lower 90s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
63 degrees at 634.
Happy to be back on WMAL. Join me, Dan Bongino, weekdays at noon beginning May 24th.
It is the Saturday morning update. It's great to have you along with us. Jennifer Harper joins us every week, and of course, you follow her column Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times and WashingtonTimes.com. Good morning.
Good morning.
Lot to be made of the loyalty to Donald Trump. Of course, the Democrats making a big deal of it every day and attacking the former president. And a lot of talk about the Republicans and what that's going to mean in 2022, maybe 2024. Interesting poll from an interesting source. What does it say?
Yes, indeed. Well, let's talk about that Republican loyalty to Trump. It is still very much intact. This is actually coming from a CBS News poll. How about that? I found these numbers sort of deep in the poll. They weren't really reported all that much, but it's very, very interesting because it's a poll of Republicans that CBS conducted. I give them a round of applause for that. And just some of the numbers here. Two-thirds of Republicans, 67%, say they do not consider President Biden the legitimate winner of the 2020 presidential election. That's coming from CBS. And, of course, the 45th president is very much on their minds. And here's just a couple of the numbers. 68% say it's important for Republican officials to support the claims of election fraud in the 2020 presidential election. 66% also agree that it's important to be loyal to Donald Trump. That's two-thirds, important to be loyal to Donald Trump. And another 65%, Rick, say that Mr. Trump generally represents their views all or most of the time. And 27% say he represents those views all of the time. Here's just a commentary from CBS. They say, Republicans say that Mr. Trump himself represents their views just as well as they think the party does. It's a personal connection to him we have seen for years. Today, loyalty also means they specifically want the party to follow more of the former president's examples across a range of items, including economics, issues of race and immigration, how to treat the media, using power and leadership and in general. Again, this is from CBS. I was quite surprised. And really some huge, hefty majorities, sometimes as high as 89% among these Republican respondents, continue to believe that Republicans should follow Mr. Trump's example of leadership and the use of power. And a soaring 89% said that the Republican Party should follow Mr. Trump's take on economic issues. They said the same about his immigration policy. And 77% agree with Mr. Trump's methods of, quote, how to treat the media. So that's CBS and the Republicans. I thought pretty noteworthy numbers there.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, I was going to make a smart aleck comment and say, you know, with the craziness in Washington State and Oregon, with the progressive management of the states, both at the state level and at the local level, and what's been going on in the cities, I was thinking maybe we could trade Oregon and Washington for British Columbia from the Canadians. But I thought it was immature, juvenile, and it was irrelevant. However, you've got a story this week that somewhere along the same lines with people in Oregon and where they might want to go.
Yes, indeed. They don't want to be in Oregon anymore. And this is kind of, if you can believe the word, Oregexit. If you've heard of Brexit and Calexit, well, this is right along the lines for that. I sort of made that up, but whatever.
It's a good one.
But anyway, you know, we do look at California, and there were several interest groups over the years that either wanted to divide California into smaller states or leave the United States altogether, and that was called CalExit. And this is kind of an ongoing thing. It's still out there percolating in California, and there's California for you. But let's go over to Oregon. And they are ready to leave Oregon. And this is what happened this week. Voters in five eastern Oregon counties voted on Tuesday to become part of Idaho. That was the counties, Baker, Grant, Lake, Malheur, and Sherman counties are now joining voters in the counties of Union and Jefferson, which made that same decision last year in favor of a new state called Greater Idaho. So they want to move into Idaho. I don't know. It's kind of hard to find out, but here's what they have to say, what prompted this whole exodus, and the grassroots group Move Oregon's Border for a Greater Idaho, that's the group behind all this, they want to flip Oregon's mostly rural eastern and southern county, plus a few northern counties in California, into Idaho. And they believe they'll be better off in Idaho's more conservative political environment. This is according to the Oregonian out there. That's a local news organization. And if the effort succeeds, 22 of Oregon's 36 counties will become part of Idaho. This is all being motivated by their sort of rejection of progressive politics, which seems to be all around them. And they say, if we're allowed to vote for which government officials we want, we should be allowed to vote for which government we want as well. And that's coming from our friends at Move Oregon's Border for a Greater Idaho.
How about that will be a fascinating legal case if that proceeds?
Well, you know, there is a sort of a historic precedent. This has happened 220 attempts to either alter a state's makeup or go with another state. So they have efforts dating to 1890 for that. I found that in the California State Library. So,
are we zero for 220?
Yeah, I think you're right, because it's a big deal, has to go through Congress and lots more.
Oh, well, it's a new millennium, what the heck. So fake news, of course, we hear that all the time, and typically you've heard that from President Trump and Republicans, but we're hearing it from sort of an opposite end of the spectrum.
Yes, indeed. Spectrum is possibly part of that, because someone has identified that there is now fake science news. And they're talking about here all of this alarming stuff about whether it's global warming or climate alarmist, all that kind of stuff. And a very interesting gentleman is identifying this as fake science news, and he is annoyed by it and also somewhat concerned. This is a founding member of Greenpeace. He's a co-founder of Greenpeace back in the day. His name is Patrick Moore, kind of an eco-realist in many days. He's gotten some nice Twitter accolades from President Trump himself. His name is Patrick Moore. He has a PhD in ecology, and he has written a new book called Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom. And he's just quite annoyed by this fake science news that's out there. He says, my book, this is what he told me, is an effort to expose the many fake scare stories, most of which are around climate change and CO2, but others that include nuclear radiation and the non-existing dangerous things in GMOs. All the scare stories about the end of the world and human civilization are based on things that are either invisible, like CO2, or so remote, like polar bears and coral reefs, that the average person cannot see what is happening for themselves. And what happens is they get alarmed. And he says this leaves us dependent on the activists, the media, the politicians, and the scientists on serial government grants to tell us the truth. But, of course, they don't. They make up the scariest scenario they can imagine and then rake in the donations, the ad revenue, the votes, and more government grants. There are billions involved in this scam. Again, the gentleman's name is Patrick Moore. He has a new book out there called Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom, getting some pretty good reviews. And he says the only way to counter this fakery is to become educated. The fear campaign is so thoroughly entrenched in daily media that it is impossible to escape. And he's saying, you know, go to the right source for your science information, because there's fake science news out there. So beware.
The congressional inquiry into the riots at the Capitol on January 6th, hot topic this week on Capitol Hill, and we've seen both sides of that story, but you've got yet another side of that story.
Yeah, it is another side. I mean, the heinous of that, we all really don't want to remember it too much, but it is a hot topic this week. And we have to go back to the date of February 24th, and that's when the architect of the Capitol revealed that the damages to the U.S. Capitol topped $30 million following the January 6th events. And, you know, a lot of this is going to go to the taxpayers to pay for these damages. This is according to some sources out there. And it also looks like the U.S. House has approved an independent investigation. People are doubting it's going to go all the way through the Senate. But one thing you have to remember, if we do go forward with this independent investigation, they cost a lot of money, too. It prompted me to go look in our little historic annals to find out how much some of these investigations cost in the past, because this comes into play. The 1992 Iran-Contra probe of the Reagan-era officials, that was $38 million. That was according to the Associated Press in 1993. Here comes another one. The investigation of former President Clinton back in the day, $79.3 million. That's according to CNBC. And we'll just do one more. The special counsel investigation of the Trump presidency, that rang up a bill of $25.2 million. So on top of this $30 million in damages, are we going to shell out another $15 million or something for an investigation? So that's something for the Senate to think of, and I hope that they do, because they may shout yay or nay on this investigation, but they might just consider skipping the investigation and drumming up a little cash for the repairs instead.
Another hot topic recently, of course, has been immigration, the southern border, and a lot of polls floating around there, but what does the NPR poll say?
Yeah, another interesting poll here. We had one from CBS, and now we have one from National Public Radio, NPR. Here's what they found. I'll just give you some, if you can put up with this many numbers this morning. 66% of U.S. adults favor fining U.S. employers who hire undocumented immigrants. That includes 73% of Republicans and 52% of Democrats. 56% overall favor ending the deportation of undocumented immigrants who served in the U.S. military. Interesting question. 51% of Republicans agree with that, along with 65% of Democrats. And 45% of Americans favor building a wall along the entire U.S.-Mexico border. Naturally, 76% of Republicans agree with that. And 21% of Democrats as well. And last but not least, 40% overall favor ending the ability of legal immigrants to bring their extended family members to the U.S. 53% of Republicans agree with that, along with 33% of Democrats. Again, this is coming from NPR, pretty straightforward, but it was conducted May the 13th through 14th, so it's pretty current.
And you always have a weekend real estate story, a kind of a neat pad.
Yes, indeed. This week I have Steven Seagal has a giant mansion up for sale, and this is a beautiful property. It's built on 12 acres on Desert Mountain near Scottsdale, Arizona. And this is a very dramatic house. It's stone and it's copper and all sorts of things like that. Very natural, very dramatic. And it's full of gorgeous windows, Rick. And every one of those windows is bulletproof glass. Only Steven Seagal could have that, perhaps. Anyway, five bedrooms, five baths, chef's kitchen, four fireplaces, multiple entertainment rooms. It's a 9,000-square-foot main house, plus a beautiful guest house as well. Theater, dining terrace, infinity pool and spa. Staggering views, they say. Three-car garage, much more. Priced at $3.3 million. If you want to take a look, and it is worth looking at, it's carefreeretreat.com. Carefreeretreat.com. Steven Seagal's place.
$3.3 million for all of that? That's not that bad.
Not bad.
I'm going to check that one out at Inside the Beltway at thewashingtontimes.com. Jennifer Harper, as always, thank you very, very much, and you have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks a lot, and have a good day, everybody.
6:48, Saturday morning update. We'll talk to Jim Trustee next, but first, Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Maryland and Elkridge on 95 southbound approaching 195, accident cleanup is still taking up all four travel lanes, but traffic is getting by on the right shoulder, but do watch out for slowdowns approaching the area. No delays on 95 beyond that all the way in towards Laurel and the Capitol Beltway. You should find traffic running at speed on the Beltway at this time, though do be aware of a new traffic pattern on the inner loop between Arena Drive and Central Avenue. The lanes divide two to the right and two to the left in the long-term bridge work zone. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
We'll see partly sunny to mostly cloudy skies today. We'll have filtered sunshine at times. It will be hotter, though. Highs back into the lower 90s this afternoon. Also, the outside chance for a stray shower through the afternoon hours, but a very low possibility for that. As we head later on tonight, lows back in the 50s to around 60 degrees under partly cloudy skies. For your Sunday, partly cloudy, still hot, highs in the lower 90s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
63 degrees at 6:49 on the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
Thank you for tuning in on the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trustee joins us each week. He's the former chief of the Organized Crime and Gang Section at the U.S. Department of Justice. He is now a partner at the IFRA law firm here in Washington. Jim, good morning.
Hey, Rick. Good morning.
Story that I was kind of scratching my head about for a number of different reasons, but let me read you a paragraph from a CNN report this week. New York Attorney General Letitia James is joining the Manhattan District Attorney's Office in a criminal investigation of the Trump Organization, an announcement from Attorney General James' office on Tuesday. Jim, tell us a little bit about the notion of these two entities basically teaming up in an investigation and the fact that there were an announcement about it, because we haven't heard anything from John Durham's probe about what's going on there. But here, they're announcing a criminal investigation. Help me out here.
Yeah, I don't know if I can help you, because it's really outrageous behavior when you get down to it. I mean, the contrast is the line of ethics. When you're John Durham and you're running an investigation that affects people's lives, the fact of being investigated can have a dramatic effect on their professional and personal lives, you keep your mouth shut. You wait until you actually do an indictment before you're getting anything out there to the public. And Durham, to a lot of people's consternation, has been incredibly quiet. And so we don't really know where his investigation is, but that's how the system is supposed to work. Now you have this partnership between very high-profile progressive prosecutors in New York, I think mainly to share the spotlight rather than any sort of need for resources, and they're announcing a criminal probe. And that's just completely unethical behavior by prosecutors. I don't know whether it's a New York thing where they think the rules of ethics don't really apply to them, or if it's the Trump exception. But really, you know, that's the thing that sticks in my craw from that report, is hearing prosecutors just announcing, you know, we're targeting someone and we're in search of a crime.
The New York Attorney General's spokesperson says, quote, "We are now actively investigating the Trump Organization in a criminal capacity along with the Manhattan DA. We have no additional comment." I mean, so why don't we just throw this out there, tarnish the Trump Organization, and then not say another word about it?
Yeah, that's exactly the strategy and that sort of approach. And look, I guess I wouldn't want them to have a lengthy press conference on it either. But it really is exactly what's wrong with politicized prosecuting authorities at this point.
So you mentioned two personalities, I will call them. Cyrus Vance, who is the district attorney for Manhattan, and then the New York Attorney General Letitia James. How much of this is political in nature versus sort of judicial?
Well, we don't know yet. I mean, you know, obviously they may have evidence that we'll see the light of day at some point. But if you look at the recent history of both of them, there are some real red flags. I mean, Letitia James came into office as an activist. She's been happily having press conferences on high-profile matters every day of the week. You know, she's announced that she's looking into sex assaults involving Andrew Cuomo. She filed a civil case to try to disband the NRA, and now she's going after the Trump Organization. What we haven't seen from her are any results. We don't really know whether there's any meat behind these accusations, but she's certainly happy throwing them out there. For Cy Vance, I mean, I really go back to the Paul Manafort indictment, which, you know, Rick, you and I talked about a while ago, on the idea of double jeopardy. I mean, that was an indictment that was politically motivated. It was saying this guy Manafort, you know, might get pardoned, so I'm going to indict him in New York. And he had a press conference on the day of Manafort's federal sentencing. And the key is, it was not only legally wrong to try to double up on those charges because of the New York double jeopardy law, but it was unethical. There's almost no way that Cy Vance's office didn't have someone in there to tell him, hey, this is going to get dismissed. This is really not a legitimate indictment of Manafort. And so, yeah, again, recent track record of both James and Vance suggests that we should at least proceed with caution, if not consider them very politicized.
Okay, we've all heard the old saying, you can indict a ham sandwich. You were talking about meat, and, you know, if that's the extent of the meat here is a ham sandwich. My question is, should there be an indictment come down anytime? You know, it could be in the next week, it could be in the next year. If that happens, what does an indictment mean?
Well, you know, technically an indictment is just the initial charging document to put a defendant on notice of what the government is alleging. It is a probable cause standard. That's a very low standard, a very low burden of proof, and that's really the genesis of those kind of ham sandwich comments, because it doesn't take much. And when you have a very dedicated prosecutor that's going after somebody, it's not really hard for them to present probable cause in many circumstances. I think that leads here to a defense strategy. In other words, if Trump or the Trump Organization gets indicted, I think there's going to be a real focus on whether there's exculpatory information that's being withheld, whether it was presented to the grand jury, and really trying to peel back the traditional grand jury secrecy to see if the prosecutors played fair. And that's always the issue with politicized prosecutors, is whether they're using the right rules when it comes to their prosecution. But very little a defense attorney can do on the front end. They just have to wait and see rather than think they can get in front of some sort of indictment.
Some of the reports are saying that this involves loan applications and the values that were involved in loan applications. What are kind of the criminal implications there?
Well, you know, there's a long history of loan application fraud cases in this country, and sometimes they expand into other areas or other charges, but it's really the same conduct. And really, they're not that commonly brought in the absence of defaulting. In other words, what you look for in a loan application fraud case is whether somebody exaggerates or lies about their assets, gets a loan, and immediately defaults. You know, it's not the situation where somebody says, hey, mom and dad, give me a gift letter so I can qualify for this loan, and then they go out and they pay their mortgage for the next 30 years. It's the situation where when you look at the package of documents that were submitted for the loan, it's clearly fraudulent because they never had any intention to pay. Again, I don't know all the vivid details of what's going on with the Trump Organization, but simply perhaps exaggerating or minimizing debt or whatever the false statement might be is not usually enough in the absence of some sort of serious default and victimhood on behalf of the financial institution.
This may be kind of a naive question, but if there is an organization that is involved in a loan application problem, is it the organization that is at fault, or is it individuals, or does it depend on kind of where the trail goes?
Yeah, it absolutely depends on the trail. It's a great question. And, you know, again, right now they're only saying Trump Organization, which would suggest a corporate prosecution rather than an individual prosecution. You know, for most defense attorneys, if you hear the notion of a corporate plea or a corporate prosecution, that's generally good news. It doesn't mean it's good news financially in terms of, you know, restitution or disgorgement or fines, but nobody's going to jail on a corporate prosecution. So that's going to be a big divider here as to whether they seek to go after individuals or just the corporation.
And much has been made of the chief financial officer, and apparently his daughter-in-law has been speaking with the media. A lot of speculation as to what he may say and would he flip to avoid any liability of his own. What's your sense of where that might go?
Well, hard to know right now, but that is the pivotal area in these types of cases. You know, I guess you have to step back and realize that if you're looking at applications or taxes, you know, tax returns that are filed, it's not like Donald Trump is sitting there with a, you know, a visor on under a banker's light doing his own taxes and application. You know, he's out golfing. He's letting other people do that. And when you have accountants and lawyers doing those things, when they get interviewed by law enforcement, that's the key moment. Are they going to say, hey, you know, if he had told me the truth, I never would have signed off on this. Or are they going to say, hey, the guy told me this and it all looks right and this is what I told him? So, you know, if they essentially stand up for the paper trail, then it gets very difficult to go after the underlying individual. If they say, oh, man, I was bamboozled, fooled, tricked, and I was completely misled by my client, then that can be a problem on an individual level that you don't have from just the paper trail itself. So that interview of the finance chief is certainly a big moment, and depending on what he has to say, it could either really short-circuit any prosecution of Donald Trump or his organization, or it could give it some life.
If something were to happen, any time, as I say, it could happen in a week, could happen in a year, it could never happen. But if something does happen, we know that the media is going to go crazy with it. They're going to spin it, obviously, against the former president and the Trump organization. What's your recommendation on how we should interpret a press conference if there is to be one announcing an indictment?
Yeah, I mean, that's a safe bet that the media is going to go crazy no matter what happens with an indictment here. But I think we have to take a rational approach. I mean, I'm a big fan of process. And in a case like this, with politicized prosecutors at the helm more than ever, you need to take a wait-and-see approach. There may be motions that get the case dismissed. There may be an indictment that gratuitously includes information about Donald Trump that never gets proven up, or at least he never gets a real opportunity to defend himself. So, you know, it's a wait and see. And also keep in mind, who are the witnesses? You know, if you're a very political prosecutor and you're determined to go after Donald Trump, are you going to rely on somebody like Michael Cohen? Or are you going to have, you know, legitimate, trustworthy types of witnesses that you can take to the bank when you go to trial? So there's a lot to see, and I hope that people can kind of reserve judgment like they should in any criminal case.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. As always, Jim, thank you for helping us out on these things.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Have a good weekend.
You bet. And you can follow Jim on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. 7 o'clock news is next here on WMAL. Then it's KT McFarland, Cheryl Atkinson, Tony Schaefer coming up in the next half hour, as well as John Gizzi. Stay with us.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. America's reopening. Hear it here. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus station.